to the ones from other systems that you've purchased for this crusade of yours. Nadashe appeared to bristle. I resent the implication that the House of Nahamepitan is acting improperly, or indeed any differently than any other house or guild when it has an interest. And what is your interest, Lady Nadashe? Cardenia asked. Our interest is avoiding the possible disruption of trade and in the lives of the citizens of the interdependency. It's also in our interest to make sure that those who attack the Emperor are seen to be punished. An Emperor who is seen as weak or vulnerable invites chaos. You would have us subjugate a constituent system of the interdependency for the optics, Cardenia said. Not only for the optics, Nadashe said, and not primarily for the optics. But for the optics too? Certainly. Cardenia turned to Ranatunga. What is the current temperature of the parliament on this? Ranatunga looked over at Nadashe before answering.
The parliament was outraged at the initial attack on your coronation, ma'am. I think it found the deaths of the alleged attackers anticlimactic. With this new raft of attacks, there's considerable support for a more robust response.
What do the MPs from End say?
When I've spoken to them, they tell me they've received no intelligence or instruction from their duke. They're dubious that the current rebellion has the reach or means to attack the rest of the interdependency. Of course they would say that, Nadashe interjected.
Or the interest, Ranatunga continued. There have been innumerable rebellions on End before. It's the nature of the place because it's where the interdependency sends its troublesome people. But it's always kept those rebellions self-contained. So they're skeptical.
Which is cold comfort to the families of the victims, Nadashe said.
Despite their skepticism, if a resolution for an imperial takeover of End were sent to the floor, it could expect support, especially now that the attacks appear to be escalating.
The guilds would also support it, Nadashe said.
It would disrupt trade, Cardenia noted.
It would temporarily disrupt trade to End, which is preferable to attacks indefinitely disrupting trade across the interdependency. And besides, End is End. It's not a significant income generator for most houses and guilds. It's 1% of my house's gross revenues. I think it's similar for most other houses.
Cardenia turned to Corbine. And what of the church?
The church would have concerns on humanitarian grounds, Corbine said, as we always do in times of conflict. But remember, ma'am, the coronation bombing wasn't only an attack on you. It was an attack on the church and on our cathedral, and, in a larger sense, the church has concern for the safety of every soul in the interdependency. If these bombings are indeed related to the rebellion on End, then for their sake, we need to consider action.
Cardenia looked at the Archbishop for a moment, thoughtful.
Thank you. What are your thoughts, Your Majesty?
Nadashe asked. Our thoughts are that until we know definitively who is behind these bombings and what their goals are, we should not act upon End. Cardenia held up her hand at Nadashe, who was clearly about to respond. We do not disagree with the assessment that these appear to be the acts of terrorists from End, but to commit to a course of action of this magnitude without proof is folly. We will let the investigations continue.
Parliament might get ahead of you on this, ma'am, Ranatunga said, especially if the attacks continue. There will be pressure from the guilds as well,
Nadashe said. We understand their urgency, Cardenia said. The troopship Prophecies of Raykella is stationed here at Hub. We can dispatch 10,000 Marines to End immediately if necessary. But we would hope the committee would remind Parliament and the guilds that we were the target of the first of these attacks. We were the first to lose people. We were the first to suffer.
we suffer still. For all that, we counsel patience. The people of End will suffer, one way or another, if we take their independence. Let us be sure.
Yes, ma'am, Renatunga said.
Nadashe said nothing. Cardinia nodded to them all, dismissing them. Lady Nadashe, we should like a word with you privately, Cardinia said, as the other members of the executive committee dispersed.
Ma'am,
Nadashe said, and stayed.
I've received a letter of protest about your appointment to the executive committee, Cardinia said, when they were alone, dropping the royal we.
It was a signal to Nadashe that the discussion would be informal and off the record.
Let me guess, Nadashe said. From the House of Lagos.
The House of Lagos is a signatory, but not the only one.
What's the problem?
They're concerned that the House of Nhamapitan has too much access to me. Between your presence on the committee, your previous association with Renarid, and the fact that your brother Amit is actively trying to get me to marry him. Nadashe smiled thinly.
With respect, ma'am, active is not the word I would use to describe it. Or perhaps more accurately, Amit is active. You are less so.
I made it clear to Amit that I would be in mourning for Nafa Dolg for a year.
Yes, you did. That is a substantial amount of time for mourning, ma'am.
She was like a sister, Lady Nhamapitan, and the mourning period includes the other victims of the coronation bombing. To attempt to shorten that period now would be disrespectful to all their memories. The third reason, which was to buy her time before considering Amit Nhamapitan as a husband, was left unsaid. But both Cardinia and Nadashe were aware of it as subtext. Nevertheless, the perception stands among many houses that yours has perhaps too much influence.
I'd remind them that I was appointed by vote by the guilds. As the houses control their respective guilds, I am the choice of the majority of the houses.
This is true. The letter reminds me, however, that while the custom is for the emperor to accept the selections of the church, guilds, and parliament for the executive committee, the emperor may reject or dismiss a member if they are not to their suiting. The letter also helpfully offers up several examples of when this has happened before.
Do you plan to dismiss me, ma'am?
Nadashe asked, and Cardinia caught the undercurrent of tension in her voice. I would not disrespect the guilds in that manner without cause, Cardinia said. But now that it has been pointed out to me, I acknowledge that the House of Nhamapitan is persistently and obviously a feature of my life, and the appearance of undue influence is an issue. It might be wise for your house to decide which it would prefer, a seat on the executive committee or a chance at imperial consort.
May I speak freely, ma'am?
Nadashe said after a moment.
Please. You're not really offering me much of a choice, are you? If I stay on the executive committee, you have an excuse to dismiss my brother's suit, and you will still have the option of dismissing me from the committee if I become troublesome. If I abandon the committee, then you still have the option of dismissing my brother's suit, which, to continue to speak freely, I don't believe you've seriously considered or planned to consider. If you want to dismiss me or my brother, then do so. It's your right and privilege as emperor. But don't use this nonsense as an excuse.
Cardinia smiled at this, and had a very slight twinge of regret that her preferences for sexual and romantic partners swung so heavily toward the opposite sex. Unlike her brother, Nadashe was not boring. And she would eat you alive, some part of her brain said. And, well, that was probably true. Nadashe would have no interest in being a quiet consort. She would want to rule, which, if Cardinia was going to be entirely honest with herself, was not necessarily a bad thing. Cardinia never wanted to be emperor. All she wanted was to be the patron of a nice little arts charity or something. The idea of having an ambitious spouse who would be happy to handle the drudge work of running an empire had its appeal.
As long as that spouse was following your agenda, her brain pointed out.
Which would be a primary problem with Nadashe Nohamapitan. Whatever her plans were, they were made well in advance of Cardinia arriving on the throne. That would be a disqualifier on Nadashe's part. Plus, Cardinia not really being interested in having sex with her was an issue. In mourning or not, it had been a damn long time since Cardinia had gotten laid.
But you don't want to have sex with Ahmet either, her brain reminded her,
which was also true enough. He had the right gender, but the wrong personality, and was so transparently a puppet for his sister's machinations that the only thing Cardinia could ever think while in his presence was, when can I leave? It was also clear to Cardinia that Ahmet found her attractive, or attractive enough anyway, which meant he would definitely want to have sex with her.
If you don't want to have sex with either of them, then you might as well marry the one who won't want to have sex with you either, her brain reasoned.
This was an excellent point, except she didn't know Nadashe's sexuality aside from ambitious. Nadashe would marry Cardinia if that was on offer. Would she want everything else that was supposed to come with it? Possibly. But that's not what Cardinia wanted.
Not that you couldn't get sex if you wanted anyway.
Which was also a thing. Political marriages were what they were, and the House of Mern, which controlled the sex work guild, had a thriving presence on Xian. She could very easily get as much service as she could stand. Certainly she wouldn't be the first emperor to do so. She knew that from the memory room, where she foolishly asked the simulation of her father about his imperial marriage, and Ottavio VI revealed the extent of his own extracurricular activity. This squicked out Cardinia, not for the fact of the sex, but because she, like most people, preferred not to picture a parent going at it. Cardinia wasn't opposed to sex work or getting sex that way if one were feeling a need and it was the easiest way to deal with it. But she didn't want that as the default for her, or to have lovers on the side doing the job of a spouse. If she was going to be married, she wanted a spouse who would be the focus for all of that. Call her old-fashioned. And beyond all this nonsense about sex, the issue of children, conventionally solvable with Ahmet Nohamapitan, technically solvable with Nadashe, but, leaving unanswered, the question of whether she wanted children with either. She didn't care for the Nohamapitans much. She had no doubt she would love any child she had, but she was worried that she wouldn't like them if the Nohamapitan personality set was the dominant one. And none of any of that changed the fact that, when it came right down to it, Cardinia didn't want to marry either Ahmet or Nadashe Nohamapitan, not only because she didn't find either attractive, but because she resented being forced into a political marriage at all. She resented the Nohamapitans for pressing a claim that she had not been party to. She resented the executive committee for tacitly and explicitly promoting their suit. She resented the political realities with the guilds that made a marriage to a Nohamapitan a prudent move in terms of the emperor retaining and exercising power. She resented her brother for dying, and she resented her father for suggesting that she didn't have to marry a Nohamapitan after all, when every other person, faction, and reality itself strongly suggested otherwise.
My life sucks, Cardinia thought to herself. I am emperor of all humanity, and my life sucks.
She laughed a little bit at that.
Ma'am?
Nadashe said, bringing her out of her reverie. Sorry, Cardinia said. I was thinking about our predicament.
May I offer a suggestion? Nadashe asked.
You may.
For my house and for my brother, I would be willing to give up my seat on the council, but only if it were because you agreed to marriage. So, let me suggest this. While you are in mourning, spend significant time with Ahmet, not merely formal settings,
but situations where the two of you could be yourselves with each other if you were together, where you might learn to see him as a partner, a consort, a spouse. On the anniversary of your coronation, tell him whether you accept him. If you do, I'll resign from the executive committee. But if not, I'll stay on, and at least Ahmet and my house have an answer. But I would need your promise that you wouldn't then attempt to dismiss me from the committee. Is that acceptable?
Cardinia thought about it.
I think so, she said. Good, Nadashe said. In that case, I have an invitation for you from Ahmet. Your construction yards have just completed the House of Nohamapitan's latest tenor, the If You Want to Sing Out, Sing Out. He invites you to a private tour of the ship with him.
When?
In 2 days.
And your brother issued this invitation when?
Yesterday. He would have sent it directly, but I'm on the committee and he knew I'd see you.
And you anticipated us having this conversation, Nadashe?
Nadashe smiled.
No, ma'am. I wouldn't have imagined that the House of Lagos would convince other houses to try to have me removed, although I'm not surprised now that I know, or could know that you and I would make a deal because of it. No, the thing is, ma'am, Ahmet actually seems to like you, so he asked me to intercede on his behalf.
You're a good sister.
I'm an adequate sister, Nadashe said. I mean, I was going to see you anyway. It wasn't any extra effort.
They both had a laugh at that.
Shortly thereafter, Cardinia was back in her private wing with Geldang. I'd like you to keep me updated on the latest about the bombing today, she said. Not just from the news feeds.
Of course, ma'am, Deng said.
Also, I have agreed to tour a new ship with Ahmet Nohamapitan 2 days from now. Please contact his people and make the arrangements. Allow for 2 hours plus travel, late afternoon. Deng raised his eyebrows slightly at this, but otherwise said nothing on it directly. Instead, he said, the Imperial Guard will want blueprints and a proposed tour path. I don't think there is a proposed tour path. It's meant to be informal. The Imperial Guard will be very unhappy about that.
Then have them inform Nohamapitan's people that there needs to be a tour path, but don't tell me. I want to be surprised.
Yes, ma'am.
Also, you asked to be told if there was ever news from the Count of Clermont on end.
Yes. In the first week of her reign, Cardinia had sent a letter to the Count informing him of Ottavio VI's passing and requesting the latest on his research. It would still be far too early for the Count to respond directly to that letter.
It's not the Count of Clermont himself, but his son, Lord Mars Clermont. He just now arrived on a Lagos Fiver and will be at Imperial Station in roughly 30 hours. He requests an audience with you.
His son?
Yes, ma'am.
We're sure about that relationship?
The note came with the same security cipher the Count of Clermont used on all his correspondence. It's legitimate.
Did something happen to the Count?
The request doesn't say.
Would you like to schedule him, or should I shunt him off?
The office of the Emperor had more than 36 protocol officers to meet with low-level officials, apparatchiks, and flunkies. If any of them were important enough to escalate, Deng would get a report and decide whether to bring it to the Emperor's attention.
Schedule him.
I can give him 15 minutes prior to your walkabout with Ahmet Nohamapitan, whatever time that is. That should be enough time for Lord Clermont to disembark and catch a shuttle to Xi'an.
Have someone meet him. It's probably his first time off-end. I don't want him to get lost.
Yes, ma'am.
Do I have anything else for the rest of the day?
Only a few minor things. Nothing that won't keep.
Cardinia nodded. Then I'm going to speak to my ancestors for a while. About political marriages.
They would know all about those, ma'am.
Yes, they would.
Cardinia nodded and headed off to the memory room.
Chapter 14. "We have two very real problems," Kiva said to Countess Huma Lagos, her mother, and the sitting matriarch of the House of Lagos. "One is bigger than the other." "Let's start with the smaller one," Huma suggested. "The fucking Nohamapetans," Kiva said. Huma laughed. The two were in the hub offices for the House of Lagos in the Guild House, the single largest commercial building on Hub. The Guild House was 700 years old and populated by some of the oldest and most influential houses in the Interdependency, with smaller buildings holding lesser houses clustered around it like supplicants. The proximity of a house's headquarters on Hub to the Guild House was a rough map of the political influence it wielded. Lagos was in the Guild House, on three low-level floors. The House of Nohamapetan was a few stories up, but held only one floor and a half-interest on another. The House of Wu, the Imperial House, held the 12 stories at the top, including the roof, high up enough that one could practically reach up and touch the top of the Hubfall Habitat Dome the Guild House resided in. Countess Lagos wasn't typically at Guild House. She ran the house from the Lagos home system of Ikoyi and let a cousin serve as the director at Hub and at Xi'an. But the Countess had arrived at Hub a week earlier to sit in on the financial negotiations for a cross-licensing agreement with the House of Jemison. Count Jemison was scheduled to arrive in 2 days. In the meantime, Kiva preferred presenting her issues to her mother rather than Lord Pretar, the Lagos senior director at Hub, whom Kiva had always considered an officious cockwomble. "What are our problems with the Nohamapetans?" Huma asked, "aside from the usual ones." "One, I'm certain the Nohamapetans sabotaged our product on end by introducing a virus and causing the Duke there to embargo us and escrow our money. Two, I'm also certain it was Granny Nohamapetan, their director on end, who convinced the Duke to escrow our money and then use it to fund his current civil war against rebels. Third, pretty sure the Nohamapetans, and specifically Granny Nohamapetan, are actually behind the rebellion on end, but I can't prove that. Fourth, and most importantly, motherfucking Granny Nohamapetan tried to put a bomb on our ship and then sent fucking pirates after us." Huma Lagos silently considered what her daughter was saying to her. Then, "just out of curiosity, if this is the smaller problem, what is the bigger problem? The complete collapse of the flow, the end of the interdependency, and the possible extinction of the human race." Huma blinked at this. "When? Over the next several years? Where did you get this information?" "From one of the passengers on the Yes Sir, who happens to be a flow physicist." "He told you this why?" "I fucked it out of him."
"And you believe him?"
"Yeah, I do. I don't understand it all, but I don't doubt at least some of it is true. We're all magnificently screwed, Mom."
"Where is this passenger now?"
"He's on his way to talk to the Emperor about it."
"Huh," Huma said, and then was quiet again, thinking. "Well, is there anything we're going to be able to do about any of the end of the interdependency shit before I sign our deal with the House of Jemison 2 days from now?"
"Not really, no."
Huma nodded. "Then let's just focus on the Nohamapetans for the moment. Now, tell me everything."
Kiva went on at length about the Yes Sir's entire sojourn at End, loudly and at length, with considerable editorial comment. At one point, the two of them were interrupted as Lord Pretar entered the room, which, as it happened, was his actual office. Countess Lagos dismissed him without even looking at him. He hastily retreated and sat in his own waiting area. After an hour of waiting, he eventually got up to get himself coffee.
"You'd be willing to get up in front of the Guild Court of Grievances and testify that Granny Nohamapetan ordered a bomb planted on the Yes Sir and was behind the pirate attack?" Huma asked after Kiva was finished.
"Of course. And you think the House of Nohamapetan was behind this, not Granny Nohamapetan,
freelancing for his own personal goals, but acting under orders of his house. I know Granny Nohamapeaton, Mom. We went a few rounds when I was at university and he'd visit Nadashe. He's not the most ambitious one in that family. I don't know what the official House of Nohamapeaton position is on the crap he's pulling on end, but I know he's not the brains of this operation.
You're talking about Nadashe, then? Kiva nodded. She's the one I actually went to university with.
Are you friends with her?
Friends is stretching it. She tolerated me when I was banging her brother, and otherwise we sort of mutually agreed that staying out of each other's hair would be the best thing for everyone. But I respect her. She's smart as fuck, and if she pushed you down a hole, she'd make it look like you jumped. If there's anything doing, she's the one doing it.
Another pause from Huma, and then, you know that for the past several months, End rebels have been bombing the shit out of things, here and in other systems, yes?
No. How would I know that? I've been away for more than 2 years, Mom.
They started, or are presumed to have started, by bombing the new Emperor's coronation ceremony. Blew up Greyland's best friend and almost got her, too. And since then, every time there's a new attack, it's Nadashe who's agitating for a military response to the guilds and parliament. And it's working. They've got a troop carrier ready to head down the flow stream to End. They're just waiting for an excuse to send it.
That fits, Kiva said. If she wants it to be sent, then she has a plan for it when it gets there.
If they go, they'd be meant to support the Duke. And you said you think Granny Nohamapeaton is secretly supporting the rebels.
Yeah, so? Either he's got a plan to make the extra military work for him, or there's something going on we're missing. Or both.
Probably both.
Huma nodded, stood up, and then clapped her hands together.
Well, let's go find out, shall we?
She exited the office and headed toward the common elevator bank. Kiva got up and followed her. 2 minutes later, the two of them were in the lobby of the House of Nohamapeaton.
I need to see Amit Nohamapeaton, Huma said to the receptionist.
Do you have an appointment?
The receptionist asked. Kiva smiled at this and immediately felt pity for the receptionist.
I am the Countess Huma Lagos, my dear. I don't need an appointment.
I'm sorry, but unless you have an appointment...
Child, I want to be very clear about something.
She pointed to the glass door, no doubt with a magnetic lock on it that separated the reception area from the rest of the floor. I am about to try that door, and once I'm through it, I'm going to Amit Nohamapeaton's office, and I'm going to try the door there. If both doors don't open for me, I'm going to do two things. One, I am going to file suit in the Guild Court of Grievances against the House of Nohamapeaton for obstruction of investigation, which, as you probably don't know, is a very serious charge and will cost the House of Nohamapeaton hundreds of thousands of marks to defend against. And then they'll lose, at which point millions of marks will flow from their accounts into mine, and you'll be fired for having caused an easily avoidable inter-house argument. Two, I'll sue you as well, and let the House of Nohamapeaton know I'll be happy to drop my suit against them if they fire you. And then, between our two houses, we'll make sure that you never work in any capacity ever again, and that the rest of your life is spent never earning more than the interdependency minimum benefit, or if you do, that everything you earn above the IMB is garnished and sent to me. And I will spend it on champagne, toasting your misery. Are we entirely clear on this?
The receptionist gaped and then buzzed the door.
Thank you, Huma said, and swept through. Kiva once again followed. Amit's office was on a far corner of the floor, and large, with impeccable furniture and wide windows that looked out on the Hubfall business district. He and two other people sat in gorgeously comfortable chairs at a table, and all of them seemed surprised when Huma and Kiva appeared in their midst. Huma pointed at the two who were not Amit.
You and you, fuck off right now, she said.
They turned to Amit, who nodded. They fucked off.
Huma and Kiva sat in their vacated seats.
Amit looked at them, and then reached over to the table and picked up a tablet, which was flashing a message alert on it. He read it.
Apparently you threatened my receptionist, Cantus Lagos, he said. Also, that's not how an obstruction of investigation charge works, and you know it.
He tossed the tablet back on the table and considered his two guests.
Now, to what do I owe the genuinely unexpected pleasure of your presence?
One, your family sabotaged our product on end, Huma said.
I don't know anything about that, Amit said.
Well, I do, and our lawyers will be speaking to yours about that. Two, your family has interfered in my daughter's ability to conduct business on end by influencing the Duke there to illegally escrow and use our revenues.
Amit glanced at Kiva.
Ah, Lady Kiva, I thought I recognized you. I believe you were friendly with both my sister and brother at one time.
Friendly isn't the word I'd use, Kiva said.
Perhaps not,
Amit said agreeably, and then turned his attention back to Huma.
Interference of trade is a serious charge, ma'am, so I assume our lawyers will be discussing that as well. I do not need to remind you that the Court of Grievances is very sensitive to being used as a way for one house to intimidate another. So if you bring a suit and lose, the House of Nohamapitan will get lawyer's fees and treble that in damages. And our lawyers are very good, and thus very expensive.
We won't lose. We're also bringing charges against your brother Grenny for attempted murder, attempted kidnapping, conspiracy to both, sabotage of a guild vessel, piracy, and extortion.
What? Amit said, less genially.
The little fucker planted a bomb on my ship and sent pirates after one of my passengers, Kiva said.
And yes, Amit, we have all the evidence we need to make those charges stick, Huma said. We have Kiva and the victim of the attempted kidnapping and murder and the crew of the Yes Sir all willing to testify.
Plus the security recordings of the attempted murder and the confession of the hitman and the recordings of the communications between the Yes Sir and the pirate vessel, Kiva added helpfully.
Huma nodded. There is that slight complication that Grenny is at least a year and a half away, which makes it difficult for him to be recalled to stand trial. But with the evidence we have, I think we can convince both the Guild and Parliament to issue a bill of attainder.
And since the little shit was the authorized representative of the House of Nohamapitan on end, we'll make sure the bill attaches to your house, Kiva said. She was freestyling off of what her mother was saying, but she was pretty sure she knew what her mother was up to and that this was where she was going with it. So why the fuck not?
I can guarantee you that the House of Nohamapitan is not engaged in any plan to destroy one of your ships, Amit said.
Don't even try that, Lord Amit, Huma said. We all know your brother doesn't have that much initiative. Neither do you, for that matter. If Grenny is doing anything, he's doing it under direction. If not from the House of Nohamapitan, then from someone in the House of Nohamapitan, which, from our point of view, is the same thing. We have no problem asking the Guild and Interdependency Courts to widen the scope of the conspiracy charge and investigate you, your sister, and, indeed, the entire fucking House of Nohamapitan.
That might be more difficult than you expect, Amit said.
Huma snorted. Just because you're trying to land the Emperor for your spouse doesn't mean you or your house is immune to justice, Lord Amit. How's that going? By the way, rumor is she's notably resistant to your charms. She might even be relieved to find out you and your whole fucking family are being investigated.
The attempted murder victim is the son of a very good friend of her father, the former Emperor, Kiva noted, helpfully.
Oh, well, all the more reason for her not to want to be seen anywhere near your felonious ass, Huma said to Amit.
As a matter of fact, I'm seeing her later today, Amit said, only a little peevishly. She's touring our new tenor with me.
That's adorable, Huma remarked and clapped her hands together. Maybe I'll have one of our people at Xi'an run over a pressee of our complaint to her. You know, give you two lovebirds something to talk about while you tour your pretty new toy.
Kiva was now looking at her mother in open admiration.
Huma Lagos had always been someone with whom one would not wish to fuck, and Kiva had years of watching her mother argue and negotiate to draw from for her own skills with both. But it was always a joy to watch her mother deftly and profanely shove assholes like Amit Nohama Peaton up against a wall, then reach down and squeeze, or reach in and twist, as the case might be. It was nice when you could look up to your parent, even as an adult, and think, "This is who I fucking want to be when I grow up." Amit sighed, brought his hand to his face, and rubbed it. "All right, Countess Lagos. What do you want?"
"Why, Lord Amit, whatever do you mean?"
"I mean that if you really wanted to bring a suit to the Court of Grievances or to the Interdependency Courts, you would have just done it and surprised us with it. The fact you're here in my office means you want this resolved another way. Fine. Tell me what you want."
"I want to give the House of Nohama Peaton a haircut."
"I don't even know what that means," Amit said. "It means that I have three things I want from you, and all of them are going to hurt."
"What are they?"
"First, you fucked with our business. We can fight about it in the court, but you're not gonna like how it turns out." Huma turned to Kiva. "How much revenue are we expecting from your trip?"
100 million marks, Kiva said.
"So, you want 100 million marks from us," Amit said.
"I want 200 million marks.
"That's ridiculous. You fucked with our product, which was bad enough, but you also fucked with our reputation. This is the cost of fucking with our reputation. So, 200 million marks in our accounts in 3 days.
Amit looked like he was going to say something else, but then thought better of it.
"Number two," he prompted.
"You might be aware we signed a letter protesting your sister's seat on the executive committee," Huma said.
"She mentioned something about that."
"Then it won't be a surprise that we want her to resign her seat."
"To be replaced by a Lagos, no doubt."
Huma shook her head. "No, but literally anyone else would be better than your sister."
"I'll tell her you said that."
"Please do. Three, you tell Emperor Greyland you've had a change of heart about the marriage."
"Come on," Amit protested.
"You're already claiming my sister's head. Let me keep mine."
"This isn't a negotiation," Huma and Kiva said simultaneously, and then looked at each other and grinned. Huma turned her attention back to Amit.
"Let's not pretend that once you're the consort, you won't still be your sister's hand puppet."
"That's right," Amit said sarcastically. "I have no will of my own."
"No, you don't," Huma agreed, not sarcastic at all. "You can work that out with a therapist if you want, but in the meantime, you give up marrying into the Imperial family."
"What if Greyland wants to marry me?"
Huma laughed.
"You poor dear, just no."
Amit seemed to deflate a little at that.
"And what do we get out of these demands?"
"Nothing," Huma said. "As in, we say nothing about what you did at End, and we say nothing for what you have planned at End."
"Really?" Amit said, and Kiva felt a rush of blood to her head.
If she had any remaining doubts that the Nohama Petans were up to no good on End, they ended right there. She felt a hand on her hand and recognized her mother was warning her off the outburst she was about to have. She held it in.
"Really?" Huma said.
"And what assurance do we have of that?"
"You want a fucking written contract on that, Amit? Are you that stupid? Understand something here. You hold no cards. Thanks to your appallingly careless brother, we have more than enough to bury you, your sister, and your entire fucking house. At the very least, you'll spend the next decade fighting off lawsuits and investigations. At worst, you'll be in prison, and your house will see its monopoly auctioned off. No matter what, it'll be bad for your business, Amit. And your sister will lose her seat on the committee, and you won't marry the Emperor anyway. This way, all you lose
is money and take a gut punch to your ego. And you'll survive both, I'm sure.
Amit considered this. I'll give you an answer tomorrow.
Or you could give me an answer now, Huma said. Countess Lagos, please,
Amit said.
As you've so humiliatingly pointed out to me more than once in this conversation, it's not entirely my call to make, and I do have a meeting with the Emperor on my schedule today. I can't exactly put it off.
Then how about this? In exactly 24 hours and 1 minute from now, unless I hear from you, a sworn affidavit goes to the Secretary of the Executive Committee and to the Emperor herself, and I'll let you and your sister sort it out from there. Fair enough?
Fair is not the word I would use, Countess.
You might have thought of that before you began all this nonsense, Lord Amit, Huma Lagos said, rising. Kiva rose with her. And before you decided to drag our house into it. She nodded and left, without otherwise saying goodbye. Kiva followed. Her last image of Amit Nohamapitan was of him reaching for his tablet and jabbing in a call code.
I fucking love you, Kiva said to her mother as they passed by the receptionist on their way out. The receptionist resolutely did not look their way as they walked by.
Mm-hmm.
Huma said nothing more while they waited for the elevator.
Do you think Nadashe will agree? Kiva said when they were in the elevator, alone.
It doesn't matter, Huma said.
200 million marks seems like it would matter. The point of the discussion wasn't to blackmail the Nohamapitans. That was just a fringe benefit. The point of it was to find out what they're up to and to unsettle their plans. Now we know what they're up to. They're planning to take over End.
Right, Kiva said. But why?
The elevator opened.
Because they know something they think everyone else doesn't, Huma said, stepping out.
Kiva processed this while they walked.
You think they know, she said to her mother, about what's going on with the flow.
They know, or they think they know, something else equally big, Huma said. They're risking a lot to position themselves in the ass end of space, and I think they're willing to give up a lot to keep it quiet.
So you do think they'll give us the money?
Huma nodded. They reached the door of Lord Pretar's office. As they went inside, Pretar stood up and started to welcome them.
Get out, Huma said.
Pretar swallowed his welcome and marched himself out. Kiva closed the door.
The money is another confirmation, she continued to her daughter.
What if they don't give us the money?
Then I think you and I had better not step out anywhere there's a direct line of sight between us and a tall roof.
But no matter what, we've just thrown a spanner into their plans and schedule.
It's going to be interesting to see what they do in the next few days.
Huma settled herself at Pretar's desk.
This friend of yours, the flow physicist.
Mars Claremont, Kiva said.
You still have tolerable relations with him?
You could say that.
Kiva thought back to a recent fuck session and smiled at it.
I want to meet him. I know you believe him, but I need to believe him too. If I believe him, I need to know how much time we have before everything really turns to shit. Then we need to find out exactly how the Nohamapitans benefit from it, and how it fucks the rest of us. I want to know before everyone else does.
Kiva shook her head.
He's meeting with the Emperor today, she said.
I don't think she's going to keep it to herself.
It's not whether she tells everyone, Huma said.
It's whether they believe her.
It's the truth.
Oh, my daughter, Huma said and smiled.
Don't tell me you don't know how little that actually means.
Chapter 15. Mars Claremont didn't realize how much of a country bumpkin he was until he arrived at Hub. It was one thing to know intellectually that Hub, which included the namesake planet of Hub, its immense imperial station, the equally immense autonomous habitat of Xian, and dozens of other associated habitats, was the most populated and advanced human nation in the interdependency. It was another thing
for Mars to disembark from the Yes Sir at Hub's Imperial Station, several times the size of N's station, and to take in the bustle and rush of so many humans arriving and departing and doing their business, and knowing that the planet below held even more people in even more crowded habitats, pressed together in underground domes or technologically advanced kilometers-long spinning cylinders, living their lives oblivious to, or simply unconcerned about, how close they were to the hard vacuum, or cold rock, or searing radiation that could kill them in minutes. These people are nuts, Marsh thought, and grinned to himself. It was breathtaking, the situations that humans put themselves into and still managed to thrive. In the interdependency, with its religious and social ethos of interconnectedness combined with a guild-centered, monopolistic economy, they'd created possibly the most ridiculously complex method of ensuring the survival of the species they could have devised. Bolting on a formal caste system of nobles intertwined with a merchant class and common workers underneath complicated proceedings even further. And yet, it worked. It worked because on a social level, apparently enough people wanted it to, and because at the heart of it, billions of humans living in fragile habitats prone to mechanical and environmental breakdowns and degradation, and with limited natural resources, were better off relying on each other than trying to go it alone. Even without the interdependency, being interdependent was the best way for humanity to survive. Except, now we will all have to find a new way to survive, Marsh said to himself. He looked up and around at Hub's Imperial Station, with all the humans moving in it, and remembered that in less than a decade, all of them might be dead, or on their way to it, including him. Lord Marsh? Marsh looked up to see a young man in dark green Imperial livery looking at him with a sign reading, Lord Marsh Claremont, in his hand. Yes, that's me, he said. I'm to take you to Xi'an. The young man looked around. Do you have any luggage? I understand you are disembarking from a Lagos Fiver. Do you have any lodgings? My luggage is being sent to the Moorland Hotel here on the station. Excellent choice, sir. Thank you. The Moorland had been recommended to him by Kiva, assuming you can afford it. Mars, currently in possession of 80 million marks in his data crypt, allowed that he might be able to scrape by. The young man motioned. This way, sir. Mars followed the young man, whose name was Versin Sona, to an area of the Imperial Station used as a terminal for travel to Xi'an. Mars had his documents checked, rechecked, and his body scanned also twice, and was asked his business in Xi'an, again twice, by two separate inquisitors. Each time, Mars noted he had an appointment with the Emperor and presented his tablet with the official appointment notice and security hash displayed. They did not ask him what specifically his meeting was about, for which Mars was thankful. He assumed about the end of the interdependency and the possible extinction of the human race might raise some flags. Versin apologized for the security measures. They've been more stringent since those horrible End rebels bombed the coronation, he said, and then suddenly shut up, aware that his charge was in fact from End. I didn't mean to imply anything about you, my lord, he said after a moment. Marsh smiled at this. He'd only in the past few hours caught up on the death of Ottavio VI, the succession to his daughter Cardinia, now Greyland II, and the attempted assassination on the day of her coronation. He personally doubted anyone from End was at all involved. It's all right, he said to Versin, who looked visibly relieved. The shuttle trip from Imperial Station to Xi'an was uneventful, but Mars watched via his tablet anyway, looking at the surface of Hub as the shuttle zipped up the termination line from Imperial Station at the equator to where Xi'an hovered 10 degrees north. Mars watched Xi'an grow larger and larger in his tablet, making out the stream of specks that represented the traffic moving to and from the habitat. Farther up and down the terminator line of Hub were other, smaller habitats,
which served as homes for the workers who built starships in nearby floating docks. Mars did not see any of those in his tablet. The shuttle landed, and Mars and Versen made their way to the train which traversed the whole of Xi'an, and Mars again found himself plastered to the view, looking at how the landscape went out, above and around him, as the interior surface of the cylindrical station looped around to meet up with the train on the other side. "Your first time at Xi'an, sir?" Versen asked.
"First time in a habitat like this," Mars replied. "I've lived my whole life on end. On the surface of a planet, it's nothing like this."
"What's it like, sir?"
"Flat."
Mars kept looking at the ground rising up at him. "Even our foothills are flat compared to this. I don't know how anyone here looks up without wondering why they don't fall right down to the other side of the station."
"Well, it's because Xi'an rotates," Versen began.
Mars laughed at this. "I understand the physics of it, that's not what I mean. But there's a difference between knowing something intellectually and the animal portion of your brain telling you to grab hold of something." He looked at Versen, who had a polite smile on his face.
"You grew up in a habitat like this?"
Versen nodded.
"I'm from Ancona. It's an associated nation here in the hub system."
"Right, so you're used to this." Mars looked back out the window.
"I'm not."
"Do you think you'll ever get used to it, sir?"
"I hope I will," Mars said.
"And I kind of hope I don't, too." They left the train at the palace station, and Versen led Mars to a landing for people who had business at the Imperial Palace. Because Mars had an actual appointment with the Emperor, Versen led him to the front of the line, annoying everyone who was waiting. Mars mouthed his apologies as Versen directed him forward. Another presentation of documents, another scan, another brief questioning, and then they were through, and Mars was handed off to a young woman. Obelise Atek, who worked at the palace proper. She gave Mars a pass to affix to his blouse and then started walking, inviting Mars to follow. Mars waved goodbye to Versen and walked after Obelise. 10 minutes later, Mars sat in the anteroom of Emperor Greyland II's office, having passed through a few public areas that displayed more opulence than Mars had ever seen in his life. Until this moment, he'd thought the Ducal Palace on End was the standard for obnoxious opulence. But the Imperial Palace made it look like the loft of an Aravist, and made his own home, a mansion by any definition, look like a hovel. The Imperial Palace was stuffed with a millennium of gilded baubles, a testament to the self-interest of a family and the political system that supported it. The anteroom was likewise tastefully stuffed with treasure, including the statue of Prophet Emperor Raikela I by the sculptor Maes Fujimoro. It was famous throughout the interdependency and probably worth more than the incomes of some entire human habitats. Mars looked around and wondered how an emperor, someone so intimately invested in the preservation of a system like the interdependency, could ever be able to act on the news he had to give her.
"You're a lord yourself," Mars's brain reminded him. "You're invested. And yet, here you are."
"Yes, but I'm not the emperor. I benefit from the system. She is the system."
"An emperor sent your father to End to study this."
"That emperor is dead."
"Lord Mars?"
Mars looked up to see Obelise motioning to him. It was time to meet the emperor. Mars got up and walked into the office.
"When you first meet the emperor, a bow is sufficient," Obelise had said to him as they walked to her office. "Some like to kneel, and you may if you like, but you will have only a limited time with her, and that will cut into your time. After your introduction, it is expected that the emperor will initiate and lead the conversation. Speak when spoken to. Answer any questions. When your appointment time is up, or if the emperor dismisses you early, bow and exit the room. Always be respectful and reserved. Your emperor deserves no less."
Mars entered the office of the emperor, took one look at the surroundings, and laughed out loud. Obelise Atek frowned at him.
"Is something funny, Lord Mars?"
asked a young woman standing in front of him. She was wearing imperial green. This was clearly the Emperor, and equally clearly, he'd just blown his entrance. He bowed. "I'm sorry, Your Majesty," he said. "I was surprised by your office."
"How so?"
Well, ma'am, it looks like a museum exploded inside of it." Obelis Atek sucked in her breath and apparently was now waiting for the Emperor to sentence him to a beheading. Instead, she laughed, openly, loudly. "Thank you," she said with emphasis. "This has been exactly my thought for the last 9 months. Sometimes I'm scared to walk around in here. I'm worried I'm going to bump into something and break a priceless historical artifact. I'm terrified of my own workspace, Lord Mars. I'm working up the courage to redecorate." "You're the Emperor, ma'am. I'm pretty sure they'll let you." "It's not whether I can. It's whether I should." The Emperor nodded to Obelis, dismissing her. Obelis bowed, shot Mars one last visual warning to behave, and left. As she did, Mars noted that he was alone in the room with the Emperor. She had no assistants or ministers or secretaries with her. "Tell me the thought you just had, Lord Mars," the Emperor said, and motioned for him to sit in a chair in front of her desk. "I was thinking that you have less staff than I expected, ma'am." Mars sat in the chair. She remained standing, leaning on her desk. "I have even more staff than I imagine you expect," she said. "And usually I will have them sit in on my meetings." "I have a lot of meetings, Lord Mars. You might not believe how many. I couldn't possibly keep them all straight without help. So, they're with me," the Emperor motioned to her desk. "And I sit behind this, and I use the Imperial we, and everyone is very respectful and polite, and no one ever laughs at this absolutely ridiculous office when they come in the room. But you did."
"Yes, ma'am. Sorry."
"I'm not. On the contrary, I'm glad you did. But I'd like to know why you did, if you don't mind, Lord Mars."
"I suppose because I'm overstimulated, ma'am."
"You make yourself sound like an 8-year-old given too much sugar," the Emperor said, smiling. Mars smiled back.
"It's not a bad metaphor," he admitted.
"My entire life has been on end, ma'am. It's not exactly the backwater everyone makes it out to be, but it's not this hub and Xian and this palace." The Emperor wrinkled her nose, and Mars was suddenly aware that whatever he had been expecting from this meeting, this was not it. "It's awful, isn't it?" Mars said. The Emperor laughed again. "I'm sorry, Lord Mars. I didn't mean to make you feel like I was trying to trap you into a faux pas. But you have to understand, I wasn't meant to be Emperor. I didn't grow up with all of this, as you say. It's as alien to me as I imagine it is to you." "I am nobility, ma'am. It's not alien, it's just a lot."
"Yes.
Yes. Again, thank you. You've perfectly encapsulated what I've been feeling about my life for the last year." "I aim to please, ma'am."
"You have," the Emperor assured him.
"So far, this may be my favorite confidential meeting I've had to date." She smiled again and cocked her head. "And this is why I'm sad that now we have to ruin it by talking about the end of civilization." Mars nodded.
"So you know. You didn't assume that I granted you this audience because I am in the habit of welcoming minor nobility, did you, Lord Mars? I mean, no offense."
"None taken," Mars said. "I just didn't know what you knew and how much I would have to explain to you.
You may assume that I know as much as my father did about what your father was up to on End, why he was sent, and what the implications of his research are."
"All right. So now that we have that out of the way, my first question, are the flow streams going to collapse?"
"Yes."
The Emperor let out a heavy breath.
"When?"
"It's already begun. We estimate the flow stream from End to Hub has already collapsed. The Yes Sir, the ship I was on, was probably the last ship to make it through."
How will we know if that's correct? When other ships scheduled to arrive at Hub don't arrive, you'll know. Ships are often delayed in their departures and, therefore, their arrivals. Mars nodded. It'll be a couple of weeks at least before people begin to notice that ship